Testing.
Good morning.
Hey, you tested. Good morning, and welcome to day two of VMworld. I see a lot of coffee cups. Hopefully that means you're waking up, and we won't put you to sleep. My name is Mike DiPetrello. I'm one of the names on the slide. I'll be one of the speakers today, as well as Lucas over here, who will introduce himself. We're going to be talking about architecting your storage. So if you're looking for racing tips or something like that, I think that's next door. So architecting your storage, this comes from a little bit of our experience, Lucas and the Alliance team and myself from a field SE standpoint and now in sort of technical marketing. And it's really about decisions in storage architecture. We're not going to go into details on every array that's in here, but we're going to go into more of concepts on how to architect your storage and get your mind thinking. So we do have about 15 minutes at the end for a Q&A when we go through this. So if you want to hold your questions till then, it'll probably be better. We can go through some Q&A at the end as well. With that, I'll let Lucas come up and go through his stuff.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Good morning and welcome to this first session. My name is Lucas Nguyen. I'm a Technical Alliance Manager. I've been with VMware about 3.5 years. Can you hear me? Can you hear me in the back? How about now? Now? Test? Okay. Thank you, Mike. All right. So I've been with VMware about 3.5 years, and in the first 3 years, I've been in R&D, and recently I moved to Alliance. My primary function really is to be the technical liaison between the OEM storage vendors and VMware engineering. Okay. Testing. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? 1, 2, 3. Okay. Hello? Better? Okay, good. All right. So we have two halves. The first half I will be discussing basically storage technologies and our architectural implementations. And then the second half, Mike will present a use case study that we did some experiments to show you some data points. So a few years ago, I did a similar lecture, and it took me 3 days to complete. I know you don't have 3 days. But I have only about 30 minutes or so. So really the goal is to give you enough information. So please take a lot of notes so you can take back and do further research. Hopefully it will give you an idea on what to consider when choosing the right storage technologies. You cannot have enough data, enough storage, but having the wrong kind of storage will really hurt your application or your business. So choosing the right storage technology for your application is the key. So from a 10,000 feet level observation, these storage technologies, you can understand them, group them into three markets. For a branch office or a independent lab research in some university, the easiest way to configure, to manage, and getting high performance is traditionally SCSI, direct attached storage, because it is using SCSI HBA. It's a dedicated parallel bus. So traditionally, it's very high performance. Now, when your business grows, meaning you have more customers, more data, there's a need to share multiple application servers with the storage. So technically feasible and most economical is to use network-attached storage. Traditionally, using NFS mount points through your normal network connectivity, and most recently with IP storage, SCSI. So iSCSI is part of three protocols for IP storage. We'll talk a little bit about the other two and the advantage of how you can use them. And when your business becomes an enterprise, Fibre Channel is really your best option because the protocol level, the dedicated network can scale. It's really, really a good protocol to support for mission-critical applications like database and so forth. So from 10,000 level, let's go to a 1,000 level foot observation. Look at this at a topology perspective. So for direct attached storage being SCSI, you're limited by the parallel bus of 16 address, but one is reserved for the HBA, and you have 15 devices left. So when you grow, you have a need for more storage. You can daisy chain the device, but again, you're limited by one PCI slot, and if you want to add more device, you're going to keep adding until you run out of PCI slots. And then you eventually have to buy a new server. And you cannot share data with among different servers and different server applications. So SCSI really was a 1979 technology. The first standard wasn't approved until around 1986. So 1983, when NetWare released their NetWare Core Protocol, NCP, and in the same year, Sun Microsystems released NFS protocol in the same year, 1983. That's really the launch of network attached storage. So traditionally, you have multiple server applications sharing the same storage. However, because you're sharing the same LAN traffic, you're bound by this traffic. So performance is bound by the number of mount points you give to the server and how busy the LAN traffic is. So in order to scale even better, in 1988, Fibre Channel came out. It was an initiative to solve parallel bus architecture. How many of you have heard of HIPPI? Okay, very few. It's a high-performance parallel bus. It was meant to use for supercomputers, and Fibre Channel was an initiative to solve that problem. But because it was so successful, it was used for Fibre Channel, used for SCSI as well. So the first standard didn't get approved until 1994. So in traditional Fibre Channel environment, you have addressing of 2 to the power of 24. So there's plenty of addresses to use, more than 16 million. Here also, network attached storage, you have millions of nodes. Now, it's very easy to scale in Fibre Channel. How many here have deployed more than 20 fabric switches? 40? Very few. 80? Oh, okay. 100? All right. Oh, 100. Wow. Please come see me later. Okay. All right. So later on, I'll go into some details about, because a lot of mission-critical data uses this fabric, there are many areas to fine-tune and investigate, right? So what does VMware support? As a VI3, we support all of these technologies. Specifically, this is something new for VI3. And also in the SAN, traditionally, we do not support FCAL. As a VI3, we do support that. So please check your if you go to VMware.com support documentation, VI3, then you'll see a list of hardware compatibility, and you'll find which of these storage technologies we support, which vendor. So disaster recovery is the most important fact in the business. You can have slow data, but you cannot lose data. Right? That's a fact. So what are the options? It's very easy to use tape, your normal RAID, and also in the rack attached storage, for example, you can have Microsoft Cluster Service, for example. Now, there is a caveat in VMware environment in direct attached storage, for example, because we take the QLogic and MLX driver and we add some magic to it for multipathing, it's difficult to identify which driver is compatible with which tape device. So it's very limited support for tape in direct attached storage with ESX server. In network environment, of course, you can use traditional LAN backup. You put the agents in the virtual machine, and you can run backup jobs that way. You have NIC failover and so forth, filer cluster. That's a very unique capability. We do also support that. For example, the NetApp filers, they have two physical filers. If one goes down, the other will go back up within 2 minutes. So we do support that also. I mentioned about LAN backup. And of course, I'll touch a little bit about data replication. Now, in the SAN, you have a lot of options here. Now, let's go a little bit about data replication. What does VMware support? So for each of the OEM partners that we work with, there are solutions already that we picked as low-hanging fruit. Basically, it's just test solutions. There's something that we can use. We test in the lab. We write up white papers. So for EMC, for example, we have SRDF, snap mirror technologies. We do support that with EMC. For IBM, point-to-point replication. HP, for example, BC and CA and data protector. We will be updating and adding new white papers to our website and OEM partner website. So please look for them in a web server near you. So traditionally in a IO subsystem or the whole system, if you look at a holistic view, IO bottleneck can really hurt the application. So when you choose a storage technology, it is important to evaluate the application demand. Specifically, evaluate CPU intensive, such as AutoCAD, video editing, for example, versus memory intensive applications like compilers, and disk IO intensive applications like backup, Oracle, Sybase, and Oracle I mentioned. Okay. So ultimately, it is the IO per second that determines the application, the speed of your application. So the analogy I like to use is you have a Lamborghini versus a Honda Civic. Now, the two cars sitting in the same traffic bound by a 55 mile per hour speed limit, they're not going to be much difference other than one has a really nice bodywork and fancy gloss paint, right? However, in a racetrack, the Lamborghini's miles per hour performance is analogous to the disk I/O per second performance in a heavy load or under intense computational requirements. So this table here is a good example of a comparison. You can look, you can Google this, just search for his name. The point here is, beyond the common parameters, one thing to note is protocol comparison between SCSI, ATA, and serial ATA. It's really the inner workings, the mechanisms in these protocols that would determine ultimately your I/O per second. So SCSI, traditionally, the key advantage is queuing. In SCSI, we have command tag queuing. There's 256 tags. It's a numeric value that's returned for a request completion notification. But the queue depth is 64, meaning you can have 64 parallel requests at the same time. And being SCSI, a big advantage is it can disconnect, do its own work, and then when it's done, it can reassert its ID on the bus, reconnect, and transmit the data. And it can do this, allowing the initiator to talk to many target in parallel. Another advantage of SCSI protocol is the SCSI device can operate at its native speed without having to degrade to the slowest speed in the bus. The slowest speed of the particular device on the bus. Now compare that to ATA. In the old days when ATA came out, they didn't have good queuing mechanism, so by default, you would have write cache enable. It's a good invention, however, because it's volatile RAM, you have data integrity issues if you have a power failure or system failure. So to resolve this problem in ATA, there is a tag command queuing. Now that's different from command tag queuing in SCSI. So tag command queuing, it's not so efficient because back up a little bit. So tag command queuing, it also has 214 tags max, but the queue depth is only at 32. Unlike SCSI, where you can do parallel execution, tag command queuing require a host intervention. So it's high overhead, adding more latency to the overall system. There are two interrupts per command in tag command queuing. The first interrupt is to set the DMA transfer, and the second command, the second interrupt is to finish the first command. So you require host intervention to make sure parallel commands can execute and finish the back-to-back command. Another disadvantage in ATA protocol is it doesn't support something called first-party DMA, which is something implemented in serial ATA. Now, serial ATA have their own queuing mechanism, and it's called native command queuing. So the word native came from the fact that serial ATA protocol allows the native device to reorder the commands and also send data, partial data, reorder the data to minimize disk rotational latency. Another advantage of first-party DMA is that you can return partial data to the first command, return partial data to the second command, and then go back later and return partial data or all completed data to the first command. So it's not quite like disconnect, reconnect in SCSI, but it's more efficient than ATA. So here's a good overall chart to really show you if you select the highest I/O per second, then you're really sacrificing space. And giving relative performance, this is what you expect. So for mission critical applications, your best choice is fiber channel because it's SCSI in the underlying protocol and for serial TA. Now, in this slide, I just want to talk about various rate levels. I get a lot of questions on what's the best rate level. The best really is to stripe across all the disks that you have to minimize disk rotational latency. And depending on your application demand, you would pick a rate level. Most people think rate 5 is the best way to go. Actually, I found on the internet that there's an organization against using RAID 5. So RAID 5 traditionally is very good for read commands, but for write, it's really RAID 10, RAID 10. And so here, ZBR means zone bit recording. In the old days, when you have, the disk implementation, you have the most sensor track at the hub. It has about 17 sectors. And as you go out the track, it remains 17 sectors. So as you can see, when the disk spins, the rotational speed out here is much higher, but you have a fixed amount of sectors. So it's not very efficient use. So zone bit recording is really to have track zero, a X amount of sector, and then when you go in, it's X minus 1, X minus 2, X minus 3, and so forth. So that as the rotational latency, the rotational speed of the drives, you can have more sectors on the outside and less sector in the inside. It's the most efficient way to put data. So the end result is one LUN presented to VMware, spanning across physical disk. Okay. So here is an experiment that was done by a gentleman by the name of Adrian Cockcroft. You can Google his name. He's famous in Sun Microsystem. Basically, he was using IOSTAT command from Solaris. IOSTAT is very common command in Solaris to monitor I/O activities, benchmark the disk. So this side here is the queue of the HDA driver, and over here is the queue of the controller cache. And we'll go a little bit into details of these slides. So I mentioned about SCSI disconnect and reconnect protocol before. This is just giving definitions of IOSTAT commands and so forth. Okay. So we'll walk through this. So this one message to take away from this slide is about destaging. Destaging is a really good invention in that it achieves two goals: maximize cache hit ratio and minimize disk utilization. So So three things, three mechanisms that allow to do this. One is you organize your disk into segments and then further divide the segments into, group them in order of least recently used, and then you have a matrix to identify which area, which dirty bits to stage, destage, meaning move the data from cache into disk. So this explains why sometimes you need to increase your cache in your disk controller. There is a disk controller cache has a fixed amount. So the goal here is to put a lot of data on this cache based on spatial locality so the application can access it. But as the application requests more and more data, this cache will get a lot of dirty bits. So you have to destage these dirty bits. So based on the algorithm, sometimes your cache will have too much dirty bits, so you need more cache. So we'll talk a little bit how you determine whether you need to really increase this cache or not. Okay. So really what is important of this here is you want to make the disk do a lot of work. But there's a method, a mechanism to monitor if you're pushing too much to the disk. So here's the next slide. Based on IOSAT, this is read per second, write per second, kilobyte read per second, kilobyte write per second. Wait is really the time waiting in queue and the number of outstanding command waiting in queue and the service time or response time, the service time or response time of the active I.O., percentage wait queue, percentage busy. Now imagine yourself standing in line in an airport. Now this is the queue for that line. And you go up to the ticket agent, now you're in that line. You're being serviced, so that's the percentage busy and the device and so forth. So in this example, the disk is not doing much at all. On this next slide here is what's interesting. You have wait time. There's a lot of people in queue waiting, a lot of requests pending, and a very busy disk. So you want to avoid this scenario, flooding the I.O. And in the future slides, I will talk about how you can adjust the queue to avoid this scenario. So you can avoid this scenario by giving your application servers multiple paths so that it spread the cost many paths. Now in VMware, pay attention to whether your storage is active-passive or active-active. Now, in the SAN compatibility guide, I created a table at the very end to show you what we support. And for each storage array type, there is a recommendation based on whether it is active-passive or active-active, the policy to set. MRU policy in ESX means most recently used. For active-passive array, doesn't matter how many paths you have, we only use one path. For active-active arrays, we set the policy to fix. We do not dynamically balance the load, but you can manually specify per run which path to take. So this would help you spread the I.O. across all available paths. Okay. Now, traditionally, the HPA QDEVs were really small in 2.1 through 2.5. For QLogic, it was set at 16. For Emulex, the default was 30. Now, in VI3, we bumped up QLogic 7.07 or 6.07 driver to 32. And Emulex remains at 30 QDEVs. Okay. So I had many discussions with engineering, and the general message was, don't change anything. Of course, you and I know it's not going to happen, right? So if you have to change any settings in ESX, this is the easiest one to set. And this is the QDEF of each virtual machine. Now, depending on what you set, by default 16, let's say you increase this to 32, you could potentially flood the I/O because you have multiple virtual machines setting its own QDEF, and say QLogic or Emulex driver using 30 or 32 QDEF, you can flood the I/O. So the best way is really to test your deployment before production, to tweak it. Because if you increase the QDEF up here, you got to provide the QDEF down here in the driver, right? So it's not a simple answer. Like people ask me, Lucas, what can I do to tweak the performance? Because it really depends on the application. By the way, you can also change the QLogic Emulex QDEF driver of the driver. But I would suggest the first step is to change this one setting. This slide was to remind me to talk about from end to end. When you consider a storage technology, for example, a lot of people use fiber channels, so I'll use that as an example. When you have an application, consider what is the application you're going to use. For example, I mentioned about CPU, memory intensive, disk I/O intensive. That would determine how much queue you need. And then from the HBA driver perspective, look at the path, how many paths you have. Let's go to this slide. That's a better example. Okay. So from the application, think of what is your application demand? How many paths do you have in the fabric? Specifically fabric, you can assign a cost to each ISL. You can trunk the ISL. You can design your fabric so that it has minimal hops. And then at the array controller, how much cache you need. So it's an end-to-end tweaking, really. So there's no easy way to identify. You have to identify the bottleneck based on your application. Okay. So going back to the other slide, that was just to recommend the best zoning strategy. So the best zoning strategy is one-to-one, one initiator to one storage processor port. Now, when I was in Brocade, we had problems with this because there was the size of the zoning database. If it gets too large during fabric merge, it will cause a lot of problems. But, you know, Brocade has fixed that over the years. So this really is the optimal way to zone your environment. Now, let's talk about what technologies you can use, you can deploy. Fiber channel, network attached storage, and DAT, and direct attached storage. You can also combine technologies together. You can bridge fabric from one location to another using FCIP. FCIP is a protocol that allows you to merge two locations together with the WAN in the middle, and that's FCIP. There's another protocol you can use is called IFCP, so look that up. That does a lot of network translation abstraction from the router. So those are the kind of solutions that you should be investigating for your application. Now, one thing I forgot to mention was every day there are advances made in science, and for each advance, there's a lot of data, a lot of raw data that needs to be analyzed. So there's one specific application that could potentially drive the CPU intensive memory and disk would be data mining. So for raw data in scientific research, this data needs to be mined to search for patterns or sequences. So at times, it could be similar to video editing. You have to mine the data, find the sequence, the patterns, and then at times, it's like memory intensive application because you have to compile this information and you can read this data. Well, what happened here? All right, never mind. I don't need that anymore. So you can read this data. So one way to design your environment is you read from a RAID 5 into D drive, for example, from D drive, and then why does it compile it and figure out the proper sequence. You can write to an E drive, but an E drive is from a RAID 10. So you can mix and match RAID like that. Determine. So basically, the message really is to fine-tune your environment based on your application data. And now I'd like to invite Mike up to give you a user case of what we did.
Thanks, Lucas. So what I was going to go through is a case study. And at first, I had a case study of just customers and architecting their storage and people that just made everything crash. And I decided to eject those slides and go with some slides that we had from our performance lab downstairs. So we actually had an array set up downstairs and decided to run through a couple of different performance scenarios or different architectures and look at the performance implications on those architecture solutions. So we actually got real hard numbers, and if you go down to the performance lab, this will be a little bit repetitive from what you do in the lab. But we used some software tools to basically say, okay, if you architect it this way, what happens? You know, where is your bottleneck going to be? Is this really a good architecture? Is this not a good architecture? As an SE, I had a lot of questions around, you know, what's really better? Is it fiber channel? Is it iSCSI? Is it NAS? Do I use raw disk maps? Do I use ZMFS-based partitions? What gives me the best performance inside of my environment? And so we took a look at some of that in our performance troubleshooting lab. So just as a quick background, architecture can definitely have a huge impact on your performance. I've been with customers before who look like they had a beautiful SAN environment set up and everything. They go to reboot an ESX host, and it turns out they have active passive arrays, and they start getting in towards this flapjacking environment where they manually load balance paths to say, okay, this first path down here, path A is going to go to storage processor A. And then path A on here is going to go to storage processor B because I want to go ahead and use the two paths, you know, on my active passive array, which theoretically you can do, especially with modern software where you have MPIO drivers in there and you can leverage that. And they mask a lot of that bad architecture that you've done in the past. Well, in an ESX environment, what happens is the first ESX server, let's say, reboots. So all of a sudden it says, okay, I'm not available here anymore. And it comes back up and it says, well, I really want what's on storage processor B to be on storage processor A now. So go ahead and trespass that one over for me. So ESX2 is sitting there and it says, oh, my lunge just disappeared that was on storage processor B. I need that back. Trespass it back for me, please. Well, it's in the middle of trespassing to the first storage processor. And you get into this big flapjacking thing. And if you have a lot of ESX hosts, all of a sudden everything just starts to go down or just times out waiting for this trespass to go along. And you start getting very poor performance because things are waiting for their disks to come back up. And the VM hasn't crashed because it has a good disk timeout in it, but you get poor performance. So we'll look at some of that in here. Now, I would like to caveat it with every environment is going to be completely different. I've had no two customers that have ever been the same, and I have served probably over 2,600 customers worldwide. Also, you can use these tests that we're going through here in your environment to find out where the bottlenecks are in your architecture. So, the architecture that we started off with was very simple. We started off with one ESX host. We started off with one virtual machine. We happened to be using a Windows virtual machine in this case, just because we were using a Windows disk mark test. We went through one fabric switch in our particular case, again, very, very simple, connected into one storage array. We happen to have about 2 terabytes of storage in our storage array. And we decided to go ahead and put the C drive for this virtual machine on its own VMFS partition. So it's on its own LUN on its own VMFS partition. And then we added 2 more LUNs and 2 more partitions and disks. One disk was its E drive, which happened to be a 10 gig disk sitting on a VMFS partition. And on the right side, for those people who are in the back, this is sort of eye chartish back there. On the right-hand side, we have an F drive on a raw disk map, so we're just going straight to the one. And we decided to run some very simple performance tests on there. We used a test tool called Iometer. It's free. It's out there, iometer.org. If any of you have ever used storage, very easy. It can run a whole battery of different tests. Our test, we did 70% random, 70% read with a 64K block size. That's fairly typical for just your normal data traffic that's going on in your environment. We did a 5-minute run just because I didn't feel like sitting there for hours, and we used a 10 gig disk at this particular time. Now, if this was a real statistical performance test, we would run all sorts of block sizes and all sorts of random reads and writes and everything like that. But again, I didn't have years and years and years to wait around for that. As you can see in the chart that's down here, and this may be a little bit eye chartish in the back, we have a smaller room when we're presenting this normally. We ran fiber channel, which was just one VM, again, running fiber channel test of this, both VMFS in the left column and VM or RDMs in the right column, and they're pretty much the same, 3294 versus 3353 for the IO per second. Throughput's basically the same, 206 versus 209 megabytes per second. So RDM and VMFS in our particular case was very, very similar. That's because our particular workload really didn't get any benefit out of it. We're doing reads. You know, we're not doing all these write transactions. If you have heavier write transaction-oriented applications, they may benefit more from RDMs, right? We didn't do a full battery of tests. So don't go home and say, oh, we should never use RDMs because that's why I do that. You know, just use big VMFS partitions. No, in certain cases, RDMs will give you better throughput. We also had an iSCSI run. So as you see in the iSCSI column, we got about 1800, mid-1800s for the IOs per second. And I concentrate mostly on IOs per second when I'm doing these runs, simply from what Lucas said before. You have the Ferrari and the, you know, Toyota Camry or whatever, both going 55 miles an hour. Who really cares about throughput unless you're doing really high block sizes? So I try to go for this IOs per second. So iSCSI actually gives you some pretty good run numbers. And then one last one we did was NAS, which doesn't use VMFS in this case. We just put the VMDK files straight on the NAS box. And that still gave us pretty good performance. We got about 1,600 IOs per second, almost 1,700 IOs per second. So it gave us pretty good impact. Now, there's some numbers that we can run. We decided to scale this out in our environment because we just have one VM, one ESX server. I mean, who has that in their environment? Hopefully nobody, right, because VMware would go out of business. So what we decided is scale this out. We put five ESX servers in our little test harness, still using just the one fiber channel switch, the one path to our one storage processor, and our one storage array. We ran these same benchmarks at this point in time in our student lab, and what we found out is the students were getting worse numbers than our pre-run fiber channel numbers. We were getting about 1,800, 1,900 IOs per second versus the 3,300 IOs per second that we're originally getting. So why is that? Why are they getting so much worse performance? I mean, we had one run downstairs, I think they were getting like 300 IOs per second. I mean, it was absolutely horrid. You know, we want to go over and check the array and make sure it's healthy. Well, we found out that on purpose, like we had decided to do, we had a bad storage architecture, right? We had a bottleneck somewhere in our environment, and we did that on purpose, specifically to show that, you know, there's a bottleneck in the environment. So we have to find out where our bottleneck is at this point in time and how we can architect our storage better to get better throughput in this environment. And so we ran some more tests. Actually, before we did that, we said, you know, there's some analysis that can be done. iSCSI and NAS, like Lucas said, still gives you very good performance. We had somebody that came up beforehand and says, hey, is iSCSI being adopted? Is it out there? Yeah, there's a lot of customers that are adopting it. Just walk through the solutions exchange and you can see some of the vendors that are providing iSCSI storage out there. So if you don't have those really high I.O. intensive applications, tier your storage. Go out there and get some iSCSI, get some NAS, and use that for your, you know, lower tier applications or your second tier or third tier applications. It can provide a lot of cost in it for you. Again, RDMs didn't really give us that great a performance for our particular workload. If you have high write intensive applications, RDMs can give you better performance in that scenario. So to go along, we think currently our bottleneck is at the storage processor, right? Because we have a lot of ESX servers going through this one little bitty path to the storage processor. So it's either the path or the storage processor. We have to figure out what that is. Or it could be the array, or it could be the architecture behind the array. So the first test we decided to run was a test to see if the path was our bottleneck. So we still have our one path. We still have our, you know, one HBA coming out of here. But now we split up the data store on the far side. So we said, okay, let's split up the data store and see if having more VMFS partitions back there gives us any better performance. This would say maybe the disks were our bottleneck or something like that. So we actually split this off, created two VMFS partitions with our two virtual machines running through the one path to the one array again, ran those tests, and what we found is before we were getting 3294 for the IOs, now we're getting 3944, so a difference of about 600 IOs per second. So that gave us a good boost in IOs per second. So it turns out either the disks or the VMFS partitions were our bottleneck at that point in time. And it actually comes out to it was probably our VMFS partitions. Split data stores and VI3 will actually give you more performance because you get more disk work queues at that point in time. In VI2, you create three VMFS partitions. You have one disk queue that goes out and services all those VMFS partitions. In VI3, we actually split it up from an architecture standpoint. You have three VMFS partitions. You have three disk work queues that can go out there and service all those requests at that point in time. Now, this doesn't mean go out and create one VMFS partition for every single one of your VMs, because that uses more memory at that point in time, which uses more heat, which could decrease your performance overall. So be selective. You might want to create one gigantic one, you know, for all your C drives, and then make D drive ones for, you know, high intensive workloads at that point in time. If you just have, you know, a file and print server or maybe a domain controller, don't split the C and D drive up. You know, those things don't use any I/O. I don't care what they tell you. Go ahead and put them on the same VMFS partition. But this is where you can strategically use raw disk maps and VMFS partitions for those more work queues to actually increase the performance inside of your environment. So that's something that's a little different in VI3. So the next test we ran is we said, okay, well, we got a little bit more performance there. Let's go on the other side and see if maybe more HDAs will give us a little bit better performance. So I decided, since I was remote, I didn't have the access to put two HDAs in a system, but I had access to two systems, so there's my two HDAs now. So we're going to use two HDAs at this point in time, going through our one storage path with our split data stores, and we want to see if that actually gave us any better performance. We want to see if maybe the HDA was our bound. Well, it turns out we just went from 3944 to 3969. So the HDAs were definitely not our storage problem path, right? Our path problem, which is down here in the middle, is the only thing that's left at this point in time. So what I wanted to do was add more paths, add more storage processors at this point. Well, again, I was remote. I didn't have access to drop more storage processors in this box, unfortunately. But what I did have access to do was use more SANs, right? Because that's the cheap way to add more storage processors. Add another array. Especially the EMC guys love that, right? Buy another array. That's more storage processors. So we added more storage processors at this point in time, so it's a little bit of a funky test, but still a valid one. We want to see if relieving this bottleneck to our two VMFS partitions will actually give us more performance. And what we found out is, yeah, we jumped from 3969 to 4201 at this point in time. So a difference of another 300 IOs per second. So yeah, one storage processor, one storage path, we had all those disk queues. So like Lucas was saying, we've gone from, okay, one virtual machine with just this one queue to the ESX server that wasn't tuned, you know, as default install. And we've opened up all those queues. We've relieved all those bottlenecks, all those roads along the way. We split the VMFS stores, which gave us more work queues in the ESX host. We went ahead and split up our virtual machines, which gave us more work queues inside the virtual machines. We added the HDAs. We added the storage paths. And all this opens up those queue paths to get us better performance inside of our storage architecture. When you do this, though, now we have multiple paths running back, just like we did with the HDAs. So like I was saying before, you can manually load balance your LUNs. You can say, okay, let's say we have all these LUNs presented out, all these storage processor paths. I can say the path to this LUN, its default is down this way. Its path to this guy, its default is down this way. And I can do that for each ESX server. If you're using an active passive array, though, you want to absolutely make sure that that's set up the same way in every single host. So when a host boots up, it's going to enumerate and it's going to say, path one, or going out HDA number one, whatever your thing is down there, maybe it's hitting storage processor A, for example, send me your LUNs, and it'll enumerate the LUNs and use those as the default path. And then HDA two, the next one in the order, send me your LUN count, and maybe it's connected to storage processor B in your LUN, in your SAN. Well, then you go pull up another host, and maybe you reverse those cables, or reverse the HDAs, and now it's enumerating it backwards. So the first thing it sees out HBA1 is actually storage processor B instead of storage processor A because you flipped the cables. Well, it's going to enumerate that, and it's going to say, okay, my primary path is down VMA HBA1 again. I'm seeing storage processor B. Oh, wait, I don't have LUNs over there. Go ahead and trespass that over there. And that's where you get to that flapjacking state. And it's typically cable-related inside of your environment because you're used to just cabling everything up and not having to worry about it. You know, let the secure path software or power path or something like that go ahead and take care of all that. Well, you can manually load balance an ESX still, but make sure you have all your cables laid out appropriately so it enumerates your LUNs. In an active-active array, you don't have to worry about it as much. Everything can be serviced out of everything at the same time. So the next thing we did is we said, okay, well, I know the HDAs can give me better performance. I know the paths can give me better performance. I went back to our simple picture and I said, well, hey, more VMFS partitions means more work queues. So I'll create more VMFS partitions But I don't want to manage all those VMFS partitions, so I'm just going to span them all together and make it look like one big logical LUN, because spans will give me better performance, right? I can stripe across my disk. The answer is no, they do not give you better performance, right? Going back to our original numbers, we went from 3294 to 3328. I think it's just a fluke that we got a little bit better performance out of there. But this does not stripe across your LUNs at that point in time. Spanning fills up the first VMFS partition until it's full, and then it goes to the second VMFS partition until it's full. So make sure that you're not trying to span these LUNs together thinking, okay, I'm striping across my LUNs, I'm going to get stellar performance, because you'll actually probably hurt your performance. Like I said, I'm amazed that we got better numbers at all at that point in time. So that was really the end of our test. I just want to put a big caveat, kind of legal statement here. This particular array that we used, these are not representative numbers of anything that you might see out of this array or any other array. You know, there's a whole battery of performance tests. But you can use this same test. You can use the same iometer workload to go back into your environment and run some of these same tests and figure out, oh, hey, maybe I'm bottlenecked here or I'm bottlenecked here. And you can re-architect your storage to get a little bit better performance out of the storage environment. So that said, that was the end of my little quick spiel. I'm a little bit faster spoken than Lucas is. He has more slides than I do. So now we'll take questions for anything that you have. Whoa, I just tripped over something. In the environment. Any questions? Yeah, out here in the middle.
So the first thing you had multiple VMFS, was that because the improvement because you were targeting a larger number of disks? Or was it because of the software bottleneck?
So the question was, when I split the VMFS data stores, was that performance improvement because of more disks that I'm hitting in the SAN at that point in time, or was it because of the software bottleneck inside of ESX? And so we've actually run some more tests that I didn't put up here for that. That particular test was because we had more disk work queues that can service out of the ESX server. So that was our bottleneck at that point in time. And that's exactly what happened. In that particular work case, I took my one LUN and I, on my disk queue that was sitting there, took that one RAID group and I just made two LUNs out of it. So I was still hitting the same amount of disks. I was actually hitting half the amount of disks at that point in time.
Those work queues? Yeah. If you have a span volume, is there one work queue for that whole span, or is there an individual work queue for each segment?
So if you have a span volume, is there independent work queues for each extent in that span, or are there one work queue for the whole span? There's one work queue for the whole span at that point in time.
You talked about better write performance with raw disk memory. What do you attribute to
better write performance? So VMFS, we have a lot of virtualization layers that we go through. But the question was, why the difference in RDM versus VMFS?
For write performance.
For write performance. So in VMFS, in the virtual guest operating system, we have a LSI logic or bus logic, so that we virtualize. So any command that goes to the disk has to go through that layer first. It goes to the virtual SCSI layer, it goes to the VMFS layer, it goes to the storage mid layer, goes to the driver compatibility layer, goes to the driver layer. Compared to RDM, the guest operating system sends the command directly to the physical device.
Go back here in the blue shirt. Yeah, we did do the same test with iSCSI. So the question was, we did the one test where we had one ESX host and we added a bunch of ESX hosts and it degraded fiber channel performance. You wanted to know if we did the same test with the iSCSI workload where we had the one iSCSI and then we put more iSCSIs on there and did it degrade the performance. And the answer was yes. It didn't degrade it as much in that particular scenario because our particular architecture, we had three NICs plugged into the back of our iSCSI target. And so it's still multipathing. We had more storage paths, more storage, infrastructure at that point in time. So that's why I didn't really put it up here. We were talking more fiber channel than iSCSI. Again, this is really like a three-day speech for him and a three-day speech for me, and 6 days crammed into 1 hour doesn't work. We'll go here, and I'll come back to you in just a second. Okay. A totally evil standing question. So the question was, as you add more lungs to the ESX host at that point in time, it becomes overwhelming, right? We add more lungs, we add more lungs, we add more lungs. Is it better to just kind of stand them together from a management standpoint, so we're dealing with one logical VMFS partition, or is that totally evil? The answer to that, I would say, is somewhat evil. that's pretty much the answer inside of engineering. Is the only time you would use spanning, my recommendation, is if you had presented a lawn, for example, maybe you have an extra 10 gigs of empty space on the end of the lawn, but you want to create a 20 gig VM. Well, you don't have the 20 gigs, so just add another, you know, lawn at that point in time, span them together, and then you can just kind of bridge over that until you go back and re-architect. Because you're not getting those disk work queues. So if you have 10 VM or 10 VMFS partitions in there, you get much better performance with those independent 10 VMFS partitions than you would with one gigantic span. You know, it's not so evil now with VI3, because in VI2, if you lost an extent in the span, then you lost the span. With VI3, we do distributed, header information. I'll basically say that my brain's a little fuzzy now with all the rock star. So we distribute that across all the extents at that point in time. So if you lose an extent, you don't lose the whole VMFS partition. We'll go there and we'll come back here in just a second. All the way in the back. Okay. Yeah, so the question was, out of all of our architectures, iSCSI, Fibre Channel, and NAS, which one of those can you boot your boot your ESX server from at this point in time? So the answer today is Fibre Channel only. There's some workarounds we've done a little bit in the lab scenario where we booted off of iSCSI, but you have to do some really weird stuff at that point in time because the iSCSI driver is not loaded. ESX boots and it's like, well, all right, how do you get there? So the stripe size of DRS?
The array.
Oh, the array. The stripe size of the array, you have any recommendations?
I have no recommendation, brother. It depends on what the application does. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very dependent thing. I mean, and it's different from every array. I mean, you have some HP arrays that, you know, or maybe Hitachi that they just do one gigantic stripe and then carve that off, and then you have other arrays that do stuff differently, and they still get better, they still get good performance in all the different architectures. So it's a very dependent, and then it depends on the workload.
Yeah, think of this analogy. I like to go back to the Lamborghini. You can have 10 Lamborghini on a racetrack, on the same racetrack, but you can tune each one of them differently, and they give you different performance. So. Yes, sir, way in the back.
That's a brutal question. So the question was, what was the vendor's theoretical throughput? They're in the solutions exchange.
Good answer, Mike.
So you can go there and ask them. You can probably figure out which array we were using to do iSCSI, NAS, and Fibre Channel on the same array. Sorry, yes, I just can't answer that.
In this example, we had about 14 disks. I striped them all. 14.
And yeah. Then you carved up the one array in multiple ones.
Yes.
So one array in multiple
ones. Yes.
Yeah. And typically, the more disks you can get, and different arrays will have a cap on how many disks you can stripe together. But the more disks you get, the more spindles you get, the better performance in theory, right?
Yes, sir. Way in the back.
No. We. Go ahead. I thought you had a follow-up question. No, our study, the iSCSI, we used our software SCSI initiator in the ESX host. We've actually run some test differences between software iSCSI inside of the guest, like just using Microsoft initiator or, you know, one of the Linux initiators. We've run tests with our software initiator, and we've run tests with a hardware initiator. Our software initiator, frankly, it rocks. It's pretty darn good from a throughput standpoint. You may, in some certain circumstances, get a little bit better performance, maybe by 2 or 3% of an initiator inside the guest, but then it depends on how many guests it's competing with on your box. Whereas the initiator, our software initiator, doesn't compete with other guests. It's actually in the kernel, which gets dedicated resources. So you get better overall performance using our software initiator. If you have high CPU-intensive applications on your box, you'll get a little bit better performance with the hardware-based initiator, but you only lose maybe the top 5 or 10% off of it without using the hardware initiator.
From a scalability standpoint, is there a difference between the software access and the initiator, because it only uses one system, with the Microsoft initiator and the VM could distribute among all the networks in the box?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. The question was, is there a difference between using our software initiator or even a hardware initiator at the ESX level because it only uses the one path versus using like a Microsoft initiator inside the VM which could potentially open up several target sessions, right, to different targets? And the answer is yes. In the case, in that particular case, multiple initiators inside the guest will actually open up independent volume, you know, target sessions, and that actually gives you better performance from an array standpoint. You won't hit the bottleneck of going to just one target session. But you can do some of the same stuff with the software initiator using, you know, virtual switch load balancing.
When the back of the striped shirt, sir?
Not as good, but.
You, yes. So that's a very good question. So I mentioned about end-to-end, you have your application, at the very end you got your disk. So really don't think of theoretical value, but think of the I.O. per second that this disk can service this application. So it doesn't matter what you drive the pipe, if you use generally more than 75% of the I.O. per second that this disk can perform, I would say either you upgrade your disk or providing more disk cache, because you're really not using the pipe. In theoretical value, the pipe is not as much, so much important until you go to 100 switches like this one gentleman here that I want to talk to him later. Because in fiber channel protocol, traditionally the bandwidth, you would never saturate the bandwidth. It's really for the internal switch ISL that really utilize that. I have yet to come across one single application that can drive the bandwidth, and potentially one I could come up with is proprietary, is data mining, and is written in some lab in some university, and that's it. Yes, sir. When choosing a vendor, what do you consider? I would say look at the solution they provide. What do you need? Do they provide data replication, support, how easy to upgrade disk cache, and so forth? So it's really, again, it depends on what the application does.
Yeah, we cover that a little bit in the scalability session that I've done as well, is that you need something that'll scale with your environment. So if you have something that you pick, like an array, and to add another array, it's, you know, a month of downtime or something, or requires 400 people to come in and implement that, probably won't scale very quickly with you. You know, if you have something where you just can plug it in, or a day, you plug it in and it's transparently integrated into your environment at that point in time, which most of the arrays do these days, then that's a lot better from a scalability standpoint going forward.
Yes, sir.
Where's the caveat, though, of being the performance for all those you want and then having PRs for a remote location? So where's the design that you have to do to be able to get that? Is there a feature in level 2 that I want to figure out what my IO per second is that I'm limited to based on whatever vendor or choice I go down? Is there anything I'm suggesting I need to look at beyond the performance to be able to get that to my DR location?
I would say yes. I mean, the question was around, you know, from an I.O. standpoint and an architecture locally standpoint, right? Is there anything that I should be looking at from a DR? You know, how does that implement with DR? You know, how does that impact DR? And one of the things in DR, right, is your recovery time objective and your recovery point objective. At what point in time do you want to be able to recover your data? You know, when you get back there, is your data one day old? Is your data 24 hours old? And that really goes along with replication, right? And how big your pipe is. I mean, if you have an OC192, for example, between the two sites, hey, you know, you really don't care. Put a bunch of I/O on there. But if you have smaller pipes, like you're replicating over a T1, and you have high I/O intensive applications, then that really does impact your array. And that impacts how you architect your array, because maybe you don't want one large VMFS partition with a bunch of stuff changing from all these different disks on that VMFS partition, because you will never be able to replicate it and keep it in sync. It might be 2 days out, 3 days out for your RPO. Whereas if you have independent raw disk maps at that point in time, or independent VMFS partitions that have different tiers, say this guy, I need to have, you know, an RPO of 10 hours. You know, I just want the data to be 10 hours old. Then at that point in time, well, we're getting the 0 minute sign. And at that point in time, you know, you can split those different volumes up and replicate them at different intervals. Maybe some are synchronous, maybe some are asynchronous. And that goes back to, you know, really the I.O. How much I.O. are you coming through? So it's a very complicated thing. And that really impacts your storage vendors. What can they do for that? Do I have to go get a third-party solution that can do this a little bit better or a little bit easier?
So unfortunately, we ran out of time. I just saw a gentleman across with a zero sign.
We'll go stand outside at that point in time, and you can come out and ask questions there.